Hi, and welcome back to the Mindful Sport Performance Podcast. I'm Dr. Keith Kaufman.
I'm Dr. Tim Pinnell.
And we are back. For any regular listeners who have been following our podcast for the last couple of months, you've probably noticed that I've been doing some episodes solo, that Tim hasn't been with us. And so we're going to do a different kind of episode today where he's going to talk about what he's been going through and what's been happening in his life. You know, for people who are used to our format, this is going to have some departures. We're not going to have an opening meditation. We may do a little exercise at the end to kind of bring things in as a group. But we're also not going to necessarily be acutely focused on sports per se, although we may bring up some parallels. But what we're going to be talking about is, you know, what happens when a mindfulness expert is himself experiencing strong emotions, in this case, grief. And Tim will talk about what he's experienced in the next moment. But I just want to set the expectations for today that this will be a different kind of episode, a different kind of focus. Hopefully it will still have relevance to our regular listening audience and things that you can connect with. But we thought this was a powerful in vivo opportunity to talk about something that's happening in real time. And as a mindfulness leader, as a mindfulness expert, how you can manage something like this. So hopefully that sets the table, that sets the expectation. And I'd like to take a few minutes and turn it over to Tim so he can share a bit about what he's been going through.
Thanks, Keith. Well, actually, before I get into the story, I guess just to say a couple things, I guess, about the frame here. Like, grief is a heavy topic. And this does really feel like kind of outside of our normal realm. And yet, it struck me as this really important opportunity. Because for what I'm going through right now, being able to talk about it is very helpful personally. But I also realized, like, grief is something that we don't talk a lot about. And certainly when I work with athletes, when I work with my clients and they come upon struggles in their life and they question, like, how does mindfulness help me with this really overwhelming thing? Like, how could this practice, sitting and breathing, possibly help me deal with something so, so big? And I guess that's part of what I wanted to show in the experience, that, like, first, it's okay to not be okay. Mindfulness isn't about being okay all the time, right? It's about how we respond in those moments when we're not okay. So I wanted to I guess, open a window into that experience to answer those questions that come up so frequently. Like, how does mindfulness help when something so, so big happens? I know I feel like we've been kind of alluding to something very, very big. And I guess I'll just say it plainly now. My daughter died. It's still hard to say that out loud. It's April 8th today. When we're recording this, she passed on February 17th. Her name was Anaya. It means empathy in Sanskrit. And she was born a healthy baby girl, or so we thought, when she was about 3 months old. She started having some troubles eating. We took her to the pediatrician and she was offered growth curves and they thought, you know, well, most likely it's an allergy. So my wife was breastfeeding. So they said, why don't you try an elimination diet? You know, remove milk and soy and eggs and we'll see, you know, we'll see. And so she did that diligently, you know, and we saw little improvement and we kept, you know, pestering the pediatricians, and, you know, what, there's got to be more. What else? Nothing's changing. It might take a couple of weeks. We don't know. We don't know. But I think finally they were like, well, the kind of kicking it up the next level would be going to see the GI. So like, we can kind of rush that referral. So it's great. And we got a referral to the GI, because again, they were still thinking it was an allergy. My wife took Anaya to the doctor on the morning of January 28th. And they noticed she was a little dehydrated. It had been a particularly bad eating day the day before. So they sent her down to the ER to get Anaya rehydrated so that they could run some tests, do some assessments, you know. But in the ER, they pretty quickly determined that there was something else going on. And some of the routine imaging they did found that there was something wrong with her heart. It was enlarged quite severely, the left ventricle. They said it was about the size of a 9 or 10 year old's heart. And that her left ventricle was so severely decreased in its functioning that she technically met the definition of heart failure. That's why she wasn't eating. And so they needed to admit her to the cardiac ICU. And for the next few days, we had no idea what was going on. She also tested positive for COVID in the ER, which like we had been so careful, you know, and because everyone in the family immediately tested. As soon as we heard that, everyone tested negative. We still have no idea how she got it, but, you know, that enacted a whole host of other kind of really onerous isolation protocols and everything. But we had no idea what was going on. We couldn't be together because of the isolation protocols. And kind of the beginning of the next week, the doctors still, they weren't sure the origin of the problem. And they thought she needs a heart transplant. And said maybe, you know, she could last about 3 months without it. So that was the trajectory we were on for a couple of days, until they noticed something else, another anomaly in her EKG that indicated it could be this very, very rare condition, that 1 in 300,000 live births. And they needed to do a cardiac catheterization, which they had opted not to do a few days before, because you need to be put under anesthesia for that. And they didn't know if her heart could handle that. But they thought if it is this condition, it kind of completely changes the prognosis and course of treatment. So we need to do the catheterization. So they did, and she made it through. And they did find that she had a condition called Al-Kappa, which is basically the coronary artery that supplies blood back to your heart, so that your heart as a muscle can work and function. It was coming from her pulmonary artery instead of her aorta, which means that deoxygenated blood was getting to the heart. And so the muscle tissue was dying. That's why it was getting inflamed and enlarged. And but the good news was that there was a surgery to correct this. And so that's what we moved forward with. We needed to wait a few days because of the COVID. They were worried about potential complications with her lungs because she would have to be on this bypass machine. But eventually she got this surgery, and she was so strong, so amazing, made it through. And then it turned out actually that where they placed the artery wasn't exactly where they needed it to be. So she ended up needing to have another surgery. And she made it through that too. Her heart, it really was. Even the doctor said in his 30 plus years of practice, he had never seen a baby her age respond just so well, so robustly to the surgery. But then one evening when we were in the hospital after the surgery, they noticed a discrepancy in reactivity in her pupils. After a whole bunch of tests, determined that she had had two large blood clots lodge in the cerebral arteries, both sides of her brain, and it had deprived oxygen essentially to the entirety of her brain, except her brain stem, which is fed by a different artery. The neurologist called it a catastrophic neurological injury. And she just they could have kept her body alive, but she would have had no quality of life. And so we made the decision to remove the machines and the medications that were keeping her body alive on the afternoon of the 17th. She quickly passed away. And I've been living in a different reality ever since. And I guess I just wanted to share with you all what that's been like. And so I've asked Keith to interview me. You know, and it might seem odd to some, as you listen to this conversation, we've both made the conscious effort to not try to take care of each other in this conversation. Not that we don't care, but we're really just wanting to apply curiosity to this experience, as intense as it is, and hopefully give some people insight into why the stuff we talk about is important so far beyond sport performance. Yeah.
Obviously, incredibly powerful. And as you said, you know, in talking about this and the questions that I want to ask you and inviting you to talk about this, obviously, we're trying to provide a window to our listeners into how someone in real time might handle something like this. And as you said at the outset, how being a mindfulness practitioner yourself, how being a mindfulness teacher might inform your grieving process, and make it harder in some ways, make it easier in some ways, make it healthier, make it challenging. Mm-hmm. There's all sides to this. So we really are not trying to put you under a microscope here. We're trying to really provide a real-time look into how someone can handle overwhelming emotional circumstances in real time. And I think maybe an important first question to start with is if you're able to share a little bit of just how are you taking care of yourself? How do you put one foot in front of the other each day?
Yeah, and that's what it feels like. I mean, really just trying to put one foot in front of the other. Actually, maybe kind of the answer to how I'm taking care of myself now is like in context, it actually matters how I was taking care of myself before. You know, I as we advocate, you know, like if you're going to be a mindfulness teacher, it makes sense to have your own mindfulness practice. It's something that I've taken very seriously. You know, so prior to all this, and ironically, like the working from home and everything within the pandemic, like helped me kind of create this routine over the last couple of years. But I had really gotten to a place where I was dedicating 60 to 90 minutes every day to me, to my health. And so that included, you know, working out, which may have been, you know, cardio or weights or yoga, a lot of stretching. As I've been getting older, I realize if I want to keep working out, I need to stretch a lot. And meditation, of course. And that, I mean, ironically, I remember having a conversation with colleagues, in the weeks before all this happened. And I said to them, like, I'm happier than I've ever been in my entire life. I have this new baby. My son was healthy. He's 3 and a half now. You know, I had like established this like really phenomenal, what I was judging as phenomenal, kind of meditation and exercise, a self-care routine, and just things were feeling good. And yeah, after Anaya went into the hospital, I mean, that immediately fell apart. Obviously, my attention was elsewhere. I stopped meditating. I stopped exercising. Was completely consumed. And I judged myself for that. Like, shouldn't I be exercising? Shouldn't I be meditating? If I'm really this mindfulness expert. But, you know, I think when we are stretched so thin, when our bandwidth is all taken up like that, you know, of course we revert to habits. And so I definitely, I don't know. I think my self-care really, really fell apart. Or I started doing some things that I had let go of a long time ago. You know, I was eating. I would like not eat at all during the day and then like eat a lot of sugary stuff at night. I started smoking marijuana a lot more. Again, in the evenings to help me calm down, help me sleep. Other than my wife, I wasn't really talking to anybody about what was going on. Keeping some close friends and family like updated, of course, but not really letting people in on my, you know, emotional experience. It's a lot of withdrawal. Those were my defaults, you know. And I judged a lot of that. Again, kind of seeing myself as what a, I don't know, what a mindfulness expert should, big capital S there, should do, right? And I was doing all these things and I thought, I shouldn't be doing this stuff. But you know, when I think back on how my mindfulness practice played into all that, I think I was at least able to be aware of those judgments. Some of them I've been able to put away, give myself a little bit more space, grace. And I think very quickly got through that withdrawal impulse to this space I'm in now, kind of why I'm here today, where something incredibly important, there feels like there's something incredibly important about opening up, about sharing, about just exposing all this vulnerability, even though it's really scary. But, you know, it hasn't just been that coping. You know, I've also very actively been reaching out for support too. I knew how important that would be even if I didn't want to, you know, so I reached out to a therapist who specialized in this kind of grief, particularly in men. My partner and I see a couples counselor. We have been, as just part of maintenance in our relationship, we're certainly leaning on her. We're reaching out to play therapists for our son, looking into support groups. And so there's a lot of other stuff we're doing to try to take care of ourselves as well.
So yeah, Tim, I mean, I hear what you're saying. And it sounds like one of the things you're highlighting is that as all of this was happening, some of your self-care behaviors, your mindfulness practice, kind of fell away. It didn't get prioritized like other things did, and you turned to other coping behaviors. And yet, it still sounds like, being the expert in mindfulness that you are, it still had a presence there in how you were operating. And I wonder if you could speak about that a little bit.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely felt its presence, you know? And I've said this now to a couple. So I have shared what I've been going through with some of the teams I've been working with, and maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit too. But one of the things I've said to them is, you know, throughout this, like, I've been really grateful that I have been meditating for the last 15 years. I mean, you know, we use this analogy all the time, right? But you can't learn how to swim when you're drowning, right? Learning mindfulness is, you know, not a thing to do when you are in crisis. It's a thing you need when the crisis comes. And I really felt the truth of that here. I think it's hard to know what my experience would have been like without having had all that experience, though it is scary to think about. But there are some things that have come up that I think I can kind of pinpoint. And one is actually around like acceptance, because there are parts of this that I feel like I have come to accept very quickly. Or at least the experience I'm having does not match the experience other people have described to me. And I'm drawing the conclusion that maybe acceptance plays a role. And a big thing is like around the question of why. I think a lot of people who go through the struggle with why did this happen to me? Why did this happen to my child, my family? And it's not like I haven't asked that question. And it's not like I don't struggle with, you know, God, how did she get COVID? And I guess that's actually an important part of the story. You know, the doctors, the way that she died, these blood clots, that essentially it was a massive stroke on both sides of her brain. It's incredibly atypical. When they first saw it, they didn't even see it for what it was. They thought like, we don't understand what we're seeing in the CT images. This is not a typical response to this surgery. And after some more imaging, they realized what had happened, and then came to the conclusion that, you know, they have seen some connection with COVID and blood clotting, and they thought that maybe it just COVID, the presence of the COVID virus in her system had like severely increased her clotting, even though she was on all these anticoagulants, and it created these massive blood clots that, you know, traveled up into her brain. So yeah, I wonder like how did she get COVID? Why did she get COVID? But it's not a question that keeps me up at night. It's not a thing I struggle with. That piece I'm not trying to make sense of. I can accept like, random things happen, you know, 1 in 300,000 births. Why us? I don't really ask that. Or it doesn't irk me or bother me or, you know. And I mean, I started seeing a therapist who specializes in this kind of loss, and I've been connecting with other families who have been through this experience, and like so many people struggle with that. Why? And I'm grateful, I guess, that I haven't. And I do think a big part of that is probably the, you know, 15 years of mindfulness practice of being able to meet reality as it is. But there's still parts I can't accept that I think I've come to understand a little bit better as I've gone deeper into this experience. Because it did feel, especially at first, just so different. I mean, qualitatively different than other life experiences, which makes sense, I guess. But what I'm really referring to, not the intensity of it, but like the presence of acceptance, I think I had gotten so used to accepting things as they are. And even as I say that, I'm like worried that I'm coming across like tooting my own horn, but like I was having difficulty meeting this reality, and it was like, oh wow, this feels so different from what I'm used to when I'm like interacting with a moment, with an experience. And it occurred to me, oh wow, because this is non-acceptance. Like a piece of the stress I'm experiencing right now is non-acceptance, you know. And it's like, to a point you made before, Keith, about drawing parallels to sport, like it does feel like there's a parallel here. You know, I use an example like this with some of my athletes sometimes, like when you show up for game day and it's colder than you'd like, or it's rainy, you know, and you tell you have the thought, I don't perform well when it's cold, or I can't perform well when it's rainy. And that thought limits you. But really what's happening is you just can't accept the reality, like, oh, it's rainy today and I got to perform. And I am aware that I'm holding on to this. I'm very attached to this belief that I will never be okay again until she's back. And of course I know that's impossible. But I'm that's the piece I can't accept. And intellectually, of course, I know. But yeah, emotionally, you know. But this is why it seems so important why mindfulness seems so important, right? Because this, I mean, the emotional intensity of this, it's like, it's like running an emotional ultra marathon, you know, and you have to train for that. Like you can't just be someone who like veges on the couch and doesn't exercise and show up one day and run 50 miles. Like it's just, you're probably not going to make it. And if you do, like you will destroy your body. And that, and I feel like an experience like this, it's just, I'm just, I didn't know I was training for this, but I'm glad. I'm glad I did. I think that's why it feels so important to share about it.
I think that's such a poignant way to highlight how, you know, something that comes up a lot on our podcast with so many of our guests is that this isn't about parachuting in. This is about integration. This is about lifestyle. This is about how we live. It's not about being relaxed and happy all the time.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. Not at all. Not at all. Well, and actually, I think another piece I feel like has been helpful about my experience as like a mindfulness teacher, a mindfulness practitioner. Actually, two things come to mind. One is that like I think that has allowed me to like really feel these feelings. Like there are days, I think my natural coping mechanism is compartmentalization. That has been something I've known about myself for a really long time. And I think it's a useful skill, I think, to have when you can use it intentionally. I think for a lot of my life, I wasn't using it very intentionally. Like, but now I really feel like in this experience, I feel like I have been able to be a bit more intentional about it, to kind of compartmentalize a bit, you know, when I have to focus on work, something like that. And to be able to choose when to bring those walls back down, to let myself be sad, and to be aware. And it's like, it's giving me choice, you know, because I've got a 3.5-year-old son. And I mean, obviously I'm worried about how this is all impacting him on so many levels, not just how he understands death and processes grief, but, you know, he's also now much earlier than I would have wanted getting all these explicit messages about how men are supposed to show their emotions, or not supposed to show their emotions, I guess. And so like, I've been very aware of myself, like, what do I feel when tears well up in front of other people? Do I feel an impulse to hide? And of course I do. Like I've still internalized a lot of that. That stereotypical kind of masculinity. But I do feel like in many moments, at least, I can be aware and actively choose to just let myself cry, be open, lean into that, which I think has been like really valuable to me, sometimes uncomfortable for other people, but really valuable for me.
Well, I wonder if you could speak to that part too. You know, obviously grief is an overwhelming internal experience, but I think, you know, you've talked a lot today about not being okay. And I think that can be hard societally, right? The pressures that we feel externally to be okay for other people, or, you know, almost by default, someone says, how you doing? Fine. Right? Like if you told them how you really feel, how long you got? You know,
that's so real. Yeah. I mean, I, this is a lot. Certainly it's a lot for us to have to deal with, and we're kind of forced to deal with it. But yeah, for other people, you know, who have a little bit more choice in terms of how much distance they keep from it. Like most people want to keep a lot of distance from this, which I get. Like I went to drop my son off at school the other day. Another parent who hadn't heard yet was there. A parent from his class, you know, was like, "Oh, hey, I haven't seen you in a while. How you doing? How's the baby?" And I had to tell him, you know, he was the first person I was able to tell without crying. Not that it's a good thing, but it's just like, it was a bit easier for me in that moment to be able to tell him without crying. But I guess it made for the, I don't know, the contrast to feel even more stark, because I could see the surprise, the fear in his eyes. He said, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." You know? And it was reflexive. This wasn't a choice, but it's like what came out of me. Like I reached out and I grabbed his arm, and the voice that I used was the same voice that I use when my son is scared. It's like, I said, Hey, it's okay. It's okay. You didn't know. And it's just like, yeah, it's so intense for other people. You immediately have to go into this caretaking mode, or at least that's the impulse. And what I'm trying to embrace is that I don't have to do that. Like if other people can't handle this, it's actually not on me. And so I've tried to be really, really honest with people. Yesterday actually is a great example. I was feeling a little bit, I woke up feeling a little bit under the weather. And for my body, honestly, just that alone, it was probably a good enough reason to take the day off, but it was absolutely like the level of illness where I would have like taken a DayQuil and like pushed through. But it wasn't just that. I also, she died on a Thursday. Yesterday was a Thursday. Thursdays are hard. And I woke up yesterday and I couldn't do it. I couldn't see my clients or go to my supervision group, or I just couldn't do it. And so I'm aware that my clients could listen to this. And so maybe I'm revealing something. I told them all I was feeling under the weather. They don't know. They know that I've lost someone, but I didn't share with them that it was my daughter. I told them I was feeling under the weather. They all understood and we rescheduled, and that was fine. But for my group co-leader, because I also run a process group on Thursdays and I go to a supervision group on Thursdays as well, my group co-leader and the people in my supervision group, I told myself I need to be honest with them, because it would be so easy to just say, "I'm sorry, guys, I'm sick today, I can't come." But that wasn't the full truth. That wasn't the most important part of the truth. I think the most important part of the truth was that the grief was just too big that day. And I needed them to know. And I know there's going to be more days like that. That was the first day like that I've had since I came back to work, where I just couldn't do it. And that was tough, accepting that. And even now I'm aware I'm using the word couldn't, and that's not true. I could have. I need to own it. I want to own it. I chose not to. I chose to be kind to myself. But I want so bad to be able to lean on, "Oh, I couldn't do it," somehow that it was out of my hands. But no, like I had to make that choice, and that's what I wanted my colleagues at least to know. Like, I'm worried about disappointing you, but I'm choosing not to be with you because I want to prioritize taking care of myself. Because if I don't, I'm not going to be able to do the things that are really most important to me, which is be there for my son, be there for my wife. And maybe that's the other piece that I feel like my mindfulness practice has really helped with, the meta-awareness as I muddle through this experience, that I am able to zoom out and like in a way that I've never experienced before have such clarity on my priorities, like where I want to put my attention, where I want to put my time. It's mind-bending to actually be able to say this, you know, that this that has been a gift from this experience.
I know I've had the privilege to get to talk to you some through this. We haven't talked as much as we normally do, of course, as you've been dealing with what's happened and spent a lot more time with your family. But, you know, you're being so honest. I wanted to sort of share an experience I had with you, because I think it's really illustrative of hopefully something that's shining through to people who are listening to you right now. I know, I think it was maybe the first or second time after you sort of came back from a leave and we were having a meeting and you were kind of being judgmental of yourself for not practicing and some of the things that you were speaking to earlier. And in fact, I called you out because you were calling yourself a quasi-mindfulness expert. And then you called me a mindfulness expert, called yourself a quasi-mindfulness or a so-called or something like that. There was some qualifier that you gave. And I was like, what are you? No, you don't get to do that. But as you were talking, it's like the mindfulness just oozes out of you. And I think that's so evident in how you're showing up today that you can say, I mean, obviously in listening to you and hearing the things you're saying, you're not okay.
No.
And we wouldn't expect you to be okay. I mean, how often do we get to stand up in any kind of public space and say, I'm not okay, and let me talk about that? And that's what this episode is really about, you know, and can't emphasize enough. We fight so hard through our institute work to not ever fall into the category of Nick mindfulness, to stay with the science, to help lead the science. And I think one of the things that we fight against every day is mindfulness as a tool. You know, people who come at it saying, okay, I get what you guys are saying, you know, do some breathing and I'll feel good and it'll make everything go away and I'll be, you know, a great performer and just these different ways that we try to turn this into a superficial tool to make everything all right. And I think what is so pointed, what is so clear in listening to you is that your training, your practicing for mindfulness, as you said, training for this moment, is not about making yourself okay. It's not about finding a moment of peace or relaxation or somehow optimizing your performance in this situation. It's literally that meta-awareness that you were talking about. It's the finding space for choices, even in moments like this, like what you're saying happened yesterday. You know, it wasn't about, hey, digging deep and I was able to recalibrate myself and show up for the meetings and push through and yay, it was mindfulness that made me mentally tough, right? It was the ability to look at yourself and say, I it's not even that I can't do it. It's that I'm choosing not to do this today and I need to be able to own that. And to be able to speak to that, to have that awareness. And you said compartmentalization is your default, but I think it's evident. You know, it's hard to compartmentalize and also be as aware as you obviously are as you talk about these things. I'm sure that you've got to do some compartmentalization because otherwise you'd go insane in wrestling with something like this. But also your ability to just in these authentic, real ways in trying to serve your clients and trying to help your peers and trying to be the best father you can be, the best husband you can be, that you can just say, yep, this is how I'm showing up today. And I understand what these choices are and what they mean. I mean, what else could we ask for?
Yeah.
And how much strength is in that? Sorry, I didn't mean to jump on you, but.
It's hard to take a compliment. I appreciate you saying all that and like reflecting it back to me like that. You know, because it like to like depersonalize it, you know, like, and I encourage, you know, people I work with, my clients and stuff, to be able to like make those choices and be transparent like that. And I tell them, you know, like, well, that's such a radical form of self-care. It's just such a, yeah, it's a radical form of acceptance, you know. And yeah, it's like so hard to give myself credit for doing that. Like I'm, yeah. Yeah, because I still feel them in there, these expectations, you know, that like we should be okay, should be able to perform, right? Wanting to believe that there is some fix to get through this more quickly, you know. But even though I know they're in there, like I can also feel how small they are, I guess, in comparison to this, to the other perspective, I guess, I have on all this about how important it is to be in touch with what I'm going through and to share that with other people and just be aware and let go of those some judgments. But yeah, sometimes they get louder. They're definitely still in there, you know, even after 15 years of doing this, like, and that's part of what felt important about talking about this too, that like, there's no perfect way to do this. And if anyone was thinking like, oh, wow, like someone with all that experience, someone who goes out and teaches mindfulness, like they would know how to navigate this kind of thing. Like, no, that's not what it's about. I don't know. All I can do is meet the moment and make the best choices I can make. That's all we're empowering anyone to do with mindfulness. It's not about knowing the exact right thing. It's about just being there and being able to be present with everything that's there so that you can make choices. And at times I can tell you it is hard and overwhelming to be present with everything that's there. Honestly, that's part of why I think I haven't been meditating. Just like sitting and looking inward right now is really overwhelming. I do feel like I am engaging in mindfulness. You know, I'm like actively and intentionally observing myself and my thoughts, but it's not the same formal practice that I had before. And like I said before, with eating or smoking, there are times where it does feel like too much, and I need a break that comes a little bit more quickly. Or I need a, not a break necessarily because it doesn't go away, but it helps me be still, I think is a good way to put it. Those other coping mechanisms. There's no perfect. It's messy. It's really messy.
And it's not linear. Right. I mean, I think that's also clear in what you're saying. It's not like every day gets a little bit better. It's there's ups, there's downs. And I think that's something I was at Virginia Tech in the aftermath of the shootings there. More than 10 years ago now. But you know, one of the biggest questions that I got from students on campus that year was when am I gonna feel better? When is this going to go away? Is it okay that I still feel these things almost a year later or a semester later? Like I still carry this with me, as though, you know, there's only an acceptable amount of time that we can grieve, or, you know, we're supposed to be healing in this linear fixed way. So I appreciate so much you saying, not only is there no perfect, but just how messy this really is. I think for anyone who's been through a grief experience, hearing someone else say that this is the way it is probably pretty validating, because we don't hear that very much. You know, we hear the cliches like, oh, it just gets easier as time passes. Like, well, maybe, but every day is different. Every moment's different.
Yeah. And that is, I mean, I think probably the most common response that comes up, that like, yeah, time will heal, you know, you know, getting back to your routines will help, those kinds of things, which I'm sure is all true. But I will say, you know, my experience of people telling me those things, it just feels like, come on, like it's the best way to do this is to get through it as fast as possible. You're going to want to minimize these painful feelings as much as you can, till you get to the other side of them, as if there's an other side. I just, you know, I know my experience of this will change, but it's never going to go away. Anaya will always be my daughter, and she will always have died on February 17th, no matter how far away from that date I get. And so time doesn't change that. You know, and so, yeah, when I hear those messages, it really does feel like kind of that there's just not space for the grief, that the realness of it isn't totally welcome.
Well, I wonder if you can take a moment. You alluded to this earlier, and I know we are kind of running short on time, and so maybe we can talk about this for a few moments and then wrap up for today. But you mentioned that you have resumed working. You're seeing clients again. You've also had some meetings with teams, mm-hmm. And you alluded to the fact that you made a choice with at least one of these teams to share a bit about what you've been experiencing and why you were absent. And I wonder, again, you know, us being a sport podcast, this isn't an episode about sports, but you know, your sport consulting work is very relevant in how you chose to show up to those meetings. And can you speak to that at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm working with two teams, both of which I've been working with for a number of years. One, I think this is our fourth year working together, and the other team is like our seventh year working together. So I have like long-term relationships with these coaches. They're college teams, so some of the athletes on them I have shorter-term relationships with, you know, but some of the seniors I've now known for 4 years. So the relationships feel real and they feel deep. I think part of that is comes from the mindfulness work that we really do encourage and invite, like authentic connection. And, you know, and we emphasize the importance of, as the instructor, as the teacher, quite like how essential it is to live mindfully. And so in some ways it felt almost like an imperative here to share this with them. Like, I don't know that I would have felt like I was being mindful, that I was being authentic if I hid this. Though that's not to say I didn't consider the impact it would have. This is heavy stuff, you know? So with both teams, you know, I had a conversation with the coach beforehand. I obviously let them know, because they are important people in my life. And we also talked through how the team might react, how they think they'd take this news. We put things in place. I mean, with one of the teams, we decided to reach out to the counseling center before we had this meeting to like give them a heads up that some athletes might be coming in for drop-in hours later. And so let the athletes know, like, if any of you need to talk about this, like, here are resources. So we did what we could to try to, you know, recognize it. Like, it's communication is a two-way street and people will be impacted by the things that I share. But even so, it just felt so important to share it just for my own, I was going to say comfort. It was not comfortable, but like, I guess comfort in like my role as a mindfulness teacher. Felt like I was fulfilling my role in doing that. But it also, I felt like, you know, really was, it's just this real world example of exactly what we try to talk to our athletes about. Like, how do you cope with unexpected stuff that like really throws you off your equilibrium? Now, yes, is this different? Is losing a child different than, you know, like missing a grounder? Absolutely. Like, those are, the difference in scale is enormous. But I think internally, emotionally, neurologically, whatever it is, the mechanism that we use, that we have to deal with that is the same. And that's the mindfulness piece. Like, how do you come to accept your reality? How do you develop the capacity to zoom out and take in a big picture, keeping your priorities in mind, being able to assess, you know, the difference between what feels important versus what feels urgent, and to really know that my actions are aligned with the things that are important to me. Like, that is hard work. We need to practice it. We need to train it. And so even though we're like coming together as a group talking about, you know, a lacrosse game, you know, the skills that are being developed, I know we have reservations about those word skills, but like the word skills, but like, the capacities that we're developing in this, like, yeah, I think incidentally they help you with your sport performance, but it is creating this underlying mechanism you can rely on when other unexpected things happen, you know? And so it felt important to share it with the teams to highlight like why I'm there in the first place And to really, because I say from day one, honestly, with a team I work with, like I'm not really here to get you better at your sport, or at least that's not the thing that's most important to me. Like, I just need to be honest about that. Like, what's most important to me is like you're happy human beings. And I happen to know that like happy human beings perform better at their sport. There's a lot of other good things that come with being a happy human being, right? So your well-being is my top priority. And I truly believe that integrating mindfulness in your life will enhance your well-being. The consequence of that is improved performance, right? But so this was like a way to show them, like, this is what I'm talking about when I say that. Like, that I want to give you something that's about so much more than a championship title. You know, it's about, it's about how you live your life in a way that at the end of the day, at the end of your life, you know, like, I acted in ways that make me believe I like left this world a better place or had a positive impact on people. I don't know. I think it's easy to lose sight of that stuff because there's so many short-term urgent things that come up. And it's just like, I remember in my life getting wound up by that stuff. I even had a conversation with a colleague just the other week where she was talking about some of these stressors. And I told her, I was like, I remember when that stuff was important to me. Like, I can vividly remember when that stuff was important to me. And now, you know, because Anaya died, because I see the world differently, I've been able to let go of a lot of that stuff. And that's like the gift I want to be giving to these teams, to all the listeners out there, to anyone I work with. Like, I don't want life to force you in the way that it has forced me to see my priorities with this kind of clarity. Like, I want someone to be able to come to that on their own.
That's interesting. I mean, obviously it's incredibly powerful. You were saying, you know, you want people to be happy human beings. And it's like, well, well-being and happiness don't necessarily go hand in hand, or, you know, maybe we can be happy in true. Aggregate, but I think what your experience really highlights is that you can be authentic. You know, you can be aware, you can make choices even while you're compromised, even while you're not happy.
Yeah.
While you're very much not okay. And I think that's such a powerful takeaway from this conversation is that, you know, I appreciate your distinction, you know, between a ground ball and losing a child. There's obviously no comparison, but I think the neurological, right, our reactions can be similar. You know, we get attached to things. We fight reality. We can't accept things. And I think so much of the power of this stuff that we try to help others, that we try to teach others to see, is that you can still be an extraordinarily effective person, even if you're in extraordinarily difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. And if you're feeling those circumstances. And I think that's what they don't tell you while you're grieving. That's what they don't tell you as an athlete, right? It's, I think the message, as you've spoken to really well today, is so often, you know, get through this to the other side, you know, feel better, feel good, you know, and to the point that we've equated, I know, you know, you didn't mean anything by this, but we've equated well-being with happiness. Yeah, and those are not the same thing.
Yeah. That's an important point.
So I can't say enough for how much I admire you for your courage, for being willing to do this. And I hope that this was of value to our listeners. Again, I know this was a departure from our usual fare, but it felt like a really important opportunity for us, and also hopefully for you to get a window into, I see, a real life, incredibly powerful experience, and how someone can respond to that with mindfulness.
Yeah. And I want to say too, I'm easy to find online. If this story has touched people and you feel compelled to reach out, please feel free to do that. I also know hearing things like this, whether or not someone knows me personally, still might feel impacted and still might feel compelled to act in some way. I've seen that a lot too. People want to be given something to do. Can I send you a card, make you a meal? You know, So for those of you out there who are feeling that compulsion to act, here's what I would ask. Just be kind. Pay it forward, you know? I named my daughter Anaya Leora. Those names mean empathy and light. That was my intention for her. And I guess I would just ask all of you who feel compelled to act to pick up that intention. Spread some empathy and light when and where you can. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this. Keith, thank you for making space.
Always. It's been an honor to talk about this with you. And again, I just admire the heck out of you that you are willing to do this. Well, maybe we can just take a moment, you know, before we exit here. We won't do our usual wrap up. You know how to find us online if you've been listening. I won't repeat our website. That just doesn't feel appropriate at the moment. But please do connect with us. And you know, if this is a first-time listener, check out our other episodes as well. But maybe we can just have a moment of quiet reflection, a moment of silence, just to kind of bring this experience to a close. And just give us like 20 seconds or so.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you to everyone who listened, and thank you so much, Tim, for sharing your story. And this is our season 3 finale. So, you know, we'll be back hopefully very soon with some new episodes, but this is hopefully a powerful way to exit our 3rd season, and hope you enjoyed our season and hope you stick with us for the future.
Yeah. Thank you all. Hope to see you again soon.